morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 21st of March. 14 degrees in Milwaukee. Oh, well. On our Facebook page, these comments from James: trillions of dollars, almost 4,500 dead, all for the biggest nothing in American history. And from Sherry: we stopped a modern-day Hitler when we killed Saddam Hussein. He had killed thousands of his own people and had already invaded another country. The UN had 17 resolutions against him. Sanctions had done nothing. It was, of course, 10 years ago this week that the war in Iraq started. And when we ask, was it worth the loss of lives? Are the people in Iraq better off now? We get completely opposite responses. Joining us this hour to talk about Iraq is Rajan Menon. He is a non-resident senior fellow in the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center. He is chair in political science at the City College of New York, and his current work concerns American foreign and national security policy, international security, globalization, and the international relations of Asia and Russia. We'll be welcoming phone calls from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. 10 years after, is the country better off? Was it worth the sacrifice in terms of human lives who were lost, 30,000 Americans who were wounded, and $2 trillion spent on combat operations and reconstruction. Rajan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's colder in Milwaukee than it is in New York City.
It's 14 degrees this morning.
I went to graduate school in the Midwest, so I remember how cold it was.
I know, but it's the second day of spring, so well, it'll happen at some point. It's hard to believe it's been 10 years. I remember that night so well when shock and awe started. It was such a dramatic presentation.
It was, and I tell my kids it was 10 years ago, and it doesn't resonate with them, but it resonates with me.
You say that people would rather forget Iraq because we're into another era because of the effects of the economic collapse. Should we have been having major conferences this week about whether or not this war was a good thing for us to have done?
Well, you know, as the two emails that you read suggest, there is, given that it is the anniversary, a discussion around kitchen tables, on op-eds, in universities, and I suspect that there are conferences going on. But I do think it's fair to say that it hasn't, say, compared to Vietnam, gotten the country involved in a deep debate. And I do think it's something that people remember, they're divided about, they'd rather forget. And I suspect that after this brief period of memorializing the war, debating the war, whatever you wish to call it, we'll be back to business. Now, part of this is because the Iraq War itself was followed by the so-called Great Recession. And in a sense, that displaced the public consciousness onto a supremely domestic matter.
Was it worth it?
Well, you know, this is the $64 million question. So my own view is not. And I say this in the following sense. Now, one of the emails that you read pointed out that Saddam was a horrible person. There's no doubt he was a horrible person. We knew that he was a horrible person. In the late 80s, when he was conducting a plan of mass killing, force evacuation, and gas attacks on the Kurds of northern Iraq, he was involved simultaneously in a war with Iran, at which point we were not supplying him arms, but we were supplying him intelligence on Iranian forces, agricultural credits, and the administration at the time did not want any congressional resolutions passed condemning this. So the idea that suddenly in 2003 realized how terrible Saddam was rings a little false to me. Not only that, but if you ask the American people, are we now going to be in the business of getting involved in countries where there are tyrannical leaders, and it's a long list, I suspect that there just isn't the political purchase needed for that kind of war. So I'm not here to argue Saddam Hussein's bona fides. everything that's been said about him is true and then more. The question is what American national security interests were served. And there I must tell you, whether it's WMD, weapons of mass destruction that Saddam was alleged to have, the Al-Qaeda connection, the connection supposedly to the 9/11 hijacking, even the administration's strongest supporters say that that's now been decisively refuted. And so we're left with Saddam is the bad guy. This is now what Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, is saying. Well, Saddam would have killed many more people and so on. That's undoubtedly true, but that is not what we were told was the rationale for the war when it began.
I think we have very little idea, and it's because this country has really fallen off the radar of television, where most people get most of their news. What's going on in Iraq now? I think one of our other goals was to help build some kind of democracy in that country. Have we done so?
Correct. Well, democracy, I wouldn't say so. But, you know, it's a mixed picture. There's no question that in terms of the ability to speak, read, write, think, there is a freer atmosphere in Iraq. It is also true that whether it's basic infrastructure, basic services, the country is a long way from recovering. But the most, I would say, pernicious effect of the Iraq war, because essentially what we did was decapitate the Saddam state and then create what in my discipline is called a security dilemma. How are people going to protect themselves? And they grouped each other together, one another, in sectarian groups, Kurds, Shia, Sunni, and so on. Now, that set off a horrendous sectarian war, particularly because Saddam Hussein's government was Sunni-dominated. All of a sudden, the Sunnis are displaced. There's a horrific civil war into which we get involved. That is continuing. I mean, if you read the newspaper, it is true that since 2007-08, at the height of the sectarian killings, things have gotten a lot better. But there are 50, 60 bombings and deaths reported on almost a daily basis. Mm. Imagine if that were happening here, how we would consider it. We would consider it a catastrophic failure. So the sectarian conflict is a very serious one. I even worry about whether Iraq will hold together in its current configuration for much longer. It's really gotten to be very, very serious.
Al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed responsibility this week for a wave of bombings and suicide attacks, 60 people killed on the 10th anniversary. Can you tell me about the makeup of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the strength of that organization?
Well, I can't tell you about the numbers, and I suspect no one can. But it's part of a wider Sunni insurgency. But one should not assume that all Sunnis who are disgruntled with the current government, which is a Shia-dominated government, that of Prime Minister Maliki, are sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. In fact, one of the things that helped the United States in the so-called surge, where we increased forces and then armed the Sunnis who had decided that they had enough of the war and wanted to sort of make peace with the United States, was that Al-Qaeda in Iraq was doing certain things that the Sunnis said, you know, we don't really want to have part of, especially because some of these guys are not Iraqis. But there's no question that there is a presence there. The interesting thing to note is that Al-Qaeda's presence was post-invasion and not pre-invasion. In other words, the whole logic is inverted, right? We were told in the beginning that Al-Qaeda was in Iraq, and therefore this was a mortal threat to the United States in the wake of 9/11 that was eminently believable because the country was in panic. And now we have Al-Qaeda established. I should just add parenthetically that the country that, in an ironic way, has benefited the most from the toppling of Saddam Hussein is Iran, which has in the Sunni Shia-dominated government of Mr. Maliki not an ally, but certainly a kindred spirit.
Do you think that it has influenced our subsequent foreign policy? I think of Syria, and we are somewhat reluctant to enter Syria in full force. We seem to be weighing who is the legitimate opposition to the government. We're treading water very carefully and slowly there. Is that a result of the way we handled Iraq?
Yes and no, and I'm sorry to say yes and no to so many of your questions, because they're good questions, and good questions are always complicated. There are some things intrinsic to the war in Syria that have led people to worry about intervention. It is a very, very messy situation. What would be the cost of intervention, given that Bashar al-Assad's army is not like Gaddafi's army? It is a more potent force. What is the nature of the opposition? What proportion of it is consists of radical Islamists versus people who have other more benign agendas? What would arming them do? Which is why most Western governments have decided that they want to more or less stay away. Having said that, the fact that we have a war still ongoing in Afghanistan and have just wound down a war in Iraq has, I think, created a legitimate worry in the body politic in the United States about whether this will lead to another multi-year commitment and a quagmire which will end more or less along the same lines. So yeah, the answer is yes in that respect.
And a final question from me before we go to our phone lines and they're all filled. We spent $2 trillion in Iraq. Where did all that money go?
Well, there was an investigation by the Inspector General of the State Department, the Defense Department. I can't really quite remember. And at one point, that report said something extraordinarily shocking, which is that there's a lot of difficulty in accounting for a lot of that money. So that I don't know. But even people who looked at this quite carefully don't know in part. Now, the cost of the war, right, ranges from, I've heard estimates of $1 trillion to $2.1 trillion, the latter if you take into account long-term veterans benefits and so on. But here's the thing. It is a classic case of when states begin wars, they always expect it to be quicker and cheaper. So the pre-war estimate was something like $60 billion. That's off by a factor of 30. Right? So there is this question of where did the money go? Can we afford to do these things given the needs at home? You asked about Syria. I think all those things come into play there as well.
Let's go to phone calls. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like to use that, because our phones are busy here, is talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Rajan Menon, who is a professor of international relations in the Department of Political Science at the City College of New York City. And we're going to welcome your phone calls starting now with Ronaldo in Beloit. Hi, Ronaldo. Hello. Hi, Ronaldo.
Yes, I did two tours in Iraq, and I believe the Iraqi war will go down as a touch of Vietnam and a touch of Korea. Vietnam, for the matter of they'll think the war was wrong, and number two, on Korea, the war will be forgotten. But what also bothers me is in 2009, Obama promised that he'd pull the troops out by 2009. And unfortunately, we didn't pull out until 2012, and I was one of the last troops to pull out. So right there, and also the war going on in Afghanistan, obviously is not going too good with his surge that he put in. So I also believe that both presidents, Bush and Obama, should be held accountable for both of these wars. And that's my comment.
Thank you. Thanks for the call, Rajan.
Well, you know what Ronaldo said, and he's a man of experience. He spent time there. And I defer to him in that respect, is a criticism that I've often heard. The Obama, I suspect, response would be something like this, that these things need to be wound down, can't be a precipitous exit, and so on. But I think there are many people in the country, and not a few veterans whom I've talked to, who would believe that that's the case. And so, you know, point well taken. The Afghan war, which he alluded to, I suspect that even when we've said we've cycled out completely, there will be several thousands of American troops still there based on the same logic that a complete withdrawal would give rise to a total chaos. So his disappointment about the pace at which the withdrawal has been done, and his point that one needs to ask questions of two administrations about this, I think is a widely shared perspective.
John and Kimberly writes, as of today, we have a near dictator in Iraq, a stronger position for Iran, much less oil leaving Iraq, and far more internal violence than under Saddam. At present, the country cannot stand on its own two feet. We stand the possibility of Iran having much more influence in Iraq and the region, all this due to our interference, complete failure.
Well, you know, as I said, there are sort of two perspectives on this, right? One is brutal dictator overthrown, America delivers freedom. And then there's this other narrative. Some of what the caller, or the emailer, was it?
Yes.
Said is correct. It is a messy confluence of the unintended consequences set off by the war because of bad planning, not anticipating an insurgency, expecting it to be done quickly, not enough troops on the ground. You may remember that General Eric Shinseki, Chairman of Chief of Staff, Joint Chiefs of Staff before the war, was reprimanded for suggesting that the number of troops that were needed were far more than what the administration was suggesting. Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and the other planners of the war felt that much less was needed. So, two things. But the biggest catastrophic mistake may have been de-Ba'athification and essentially the dismantling of the military, because that led to two effects. The institutions of the state crumbled and sectarian war followed because people began to ask, well, how do I protect myself? Well, I protect myself by relying on my group. But the other thing is that a lot of Iraqi soldiers who had been discharged, and many of whom were Sunnis, took their arms and their training and joined the insurgents. So, yes, and in terms of the current government, you know, it is by no means a perfect government. I think to call it a dictatorial government along the lines of Saddam Hussein is probably overwrought. I'm not in any shape or form certifying the Maliki government, and I think Iraqis are deeply divided, not just Sunnis and Kurds, but even within the Shia community itself. But even if it's the case that Saddam is gone and now a different government is here, I think that we often vastly underestimate our knowledge of countries, the number of moving parts there are, and the difficulty of transitioning from regime change to managing the after effects. It's not something that we're very, very good at, and I don't think we have a lot of patience for. You know, patience is not necessarily an American virtue, and these things take a very long time. They're often hazardous. Failure is quite likely, and the price tag is very, very high. You asked earlier about Syria. Some of the worries about nation building, some of the concerns reflected in the email that you just read, have something to do, as I mentioned, with the reticence about getting involved in Syria, where, look, 70,000 people have been killed in 2 years.
More phone calls in just one moment. Iraq, 10 years after, is our subject, the first hour of our program today. Rajan Menon is our guest. He's a professor of international relations in the Department of Political Science at the City College of New York University, and he is a senior fellow in the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Thursday. For more than 30 years, David Drake has traveled all over this lovely state performing a multimedia program telling the story of Wisconsin history. And he does so through song and through playing historic, sometimes musical instruments. He's a songwriter. He is a performer and historian. He'll be with us hour two of our show. We go to Ryan next in Hazel Green. Hello, Ryan.
Hello. I'm an Iraq war veteran. I was part of the invasion in 03, 3rd Infantry Division. I was one of the first into Baghdad, and then I stayed in Baghdad for 16 months after the invasion. So I watched things turn bad very quick in Baghdad in the space of about 3 months in the summer there of 2003 because of the lack of planning and on the Secretary of Defense's part. Things just went from bad to worse, and it just kept continuing, going down the drain. The question is whether or not it was worth it. I can say my personal opinion is no. I can think of, there's a good analogy I like to think about when I think about Iraq. Think about all the trees in the town that you live in. think all the trees lining the streets of Madison. In Baghdad, those trees were date palms, and they used to be everywhere, along every street, along every road. But the insurgents started tying IEDs into the tops of the trees so they could kill our gunners. So the American forces, we ended up cutting down almost all the trees in the city of 6 million people. So I can think of no better analogy of what I think our country's done to that country.
Ryan, did you have hopes when you started, you were part of the initial invasion, that this was going to bring good things to Iraq?
Yes, and actually I lived pretty much out on the street, and I talked to a lot of Iraqis, and I'd ask them, you know, what they thought. And initially, people were very happy that we were there, because nobody liked Saddam, because everybody's life was touched by Saddam, because he was, you know, a brutal dictator. But as the, you know, year turned into 16 months further on down the line, in that power vacuum that happened when Saddam was overthrown, they turned their hatred to us, and I don't blame them one bit. And think about how long it takes a tree to grow back. That's how much damage we've done to our reputation in the Middle East.
Rajan.
Well, I think Ryan's tree analogy is just brilliant in so many ways, symbolically, in terms of how long the tree takes to grow, and all of this. And the 3rd ID, 3rd Infantry Division, really was, you know, sort of the tip of the spear, and I'm sure he knows what he speaks of. It's a pity, in a way, that people like Ryan and Ronaldo, the other vet who called in, that no one's done an oral history where we talk not to the top brass or the top leaders, but to those who are on the ground day to day watching this. Because I think that would give us a very, very different picture of what was going on. They may not all agree, but we'd get a deep textured grassroots picture of what was happening. You know, Ryan made a point that he didn't disagree with the Iraqis who then turned against the U.S. And here's, I don't know if he'd agree with this, but here's my sense of why that is. So there is a sort of love-hate relationship with the United States and much of the world. Our power makes us feared as well as admired. So it is true that when we went into Iraq, the overwhelming response, certainly of the non-Sunni, but even some Sunni, was that the Americans had come, the dictator was gone. And then there was this assumption that because we're seen as so competent and so powerful, that we would handle this well. And when we didn't handle it well, first there was disappointment, but a willingness to give us time. And then the narrative went from, well, it's not just incompetence. They're deliberately here to screw things up, to take over the country, to take over the oil. And so you had that narrative as well. Iraqis are divided, you know, now on the war. Some will say, well, it's good, Saddam's gone, I'm freer. Others will say, well, the invasion has left a mess. There's as much division on the war there as here. But his point about the imagery of the tree, I think, is really quite striking.
Yes, it is. Very striking. Thank you, Ryan, for your call. John in Grand Rapids. Hi.
Hello. I think it's a failure both domestically and in terms of foreign policy. First, you have a picture of Donald Rumsfeld with the supposed horrible dictator in the 80s when he's our friend. And I think that duplicitous relationship with this guy is not lost on the average person in the Middle East. And then you have, on the home front, you have uneven and even no sacrifice by people who are getting, the wealthy who are getting tax breaks, and their kids aren't fighting in this war. You know, it's just not a shared sacrifice. And I remember when George Bush ran for president in 2000, he distinctly ran on a campaign where he didn't think the United States should be the world's policeman, which I think was a reaction to Black Hawk Down from Clinton. But, you know, there were so many lies leading up to that war. It just left me feeling that I don't trust conservatives at all.
Rajan.
What was the caller's name, Diane? I'm sorry.
John.
John. So a couple of things I'd like to pick up on what John said. In Vietnam, there was a draft, which meant that a larger cross-section of Americans was participating in the war. And while many things ended the war, it was the tumult at home, Kent State, the campus uprisings, the anti-war movement, There was nothing like that in Iraq, and I think a point that John brought up is worth thinking about. What if there had been a draft? Whatever one may think of the draft, there should be, shouldn't be. That's not what I'm getting into here. Had a larger cross-section of the public been made to bear the direct consequences of this war, rather than simply, you know, tie yellow ribbons around our trees and wave flags? I'm not belittling any of that, right? But that's easy. Most of us, myself included, were called upon to do very little. What if a larger cross-section had participated? Would it have made a difference? The Rumsfeld-Saddam photograph, and I think John is quite right, it's remembered in the Middle East. And when I said earlier that the narrative that Saddam was a bad guy and had to be overthrown is made, there is a little bit of a historical amnesia because we have a rather more complicated relationship with this man than we might think. I remember back in the 80s, one of the most celebrated ambassadors, the man about town in Washington, D.C., next to Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador, who's legendary for his access and influence and parties and charisma, and perhaps a British ambassador and the Israeli ambassador, was one Nizar Hamdoun. Who was Nizar Hamdoun? He was the Iraqi ambassador to the United States.
Hmm. Thank you, John, very much for your call. George in Milwaukee, hello.
Yes, hi. One of the things that disturbs me about some of our wars, Vietnam and Iraq also, is how we seem to dismiss the number of local people who suffer, die, are killed, injured, and so on. So when we talk about Vietnam, we're only talking about the 55,000 Americans who died, seldom giving mention to the 2 million Vietnamese. Regarding Iraq, I'm curious if the guest has a thought on how many Iraqis actually died. You know, the British medical journal, The Lancet, came out, I think it's maybe 5 years ago now, indicating from some of the studies that they had done that possibly up to 1 million Iraqis had been killed in the war. However, the figure that we usually see bandied about now is closer to about 100,000. I think this makes a bit of a difference. certainly made a big difference to the people who died and their loved ones. I wonder if the guests could comment.
Right. George, you know, I can't give you a precise figure. And as you know, because you've referenced Lancet and obviously you've looked into this, there's a range. So the lower range by the Iraq body count, it's a pretty respected website that collates sources from a variety of secondary sources, cross-references them and so on, is between 111 and 122,000. Even if you take that lower number, that's 25 times the number of our troops who died. And incidentally, not only are Iraqi deaths lost sight of in this discussion about the anniversary of the war, as George quite rightly points out, 30,000 of our veterans were severely injured. They, you know, it seems to me, have really been lost sight of in discussion, some of them with traumatic injuries. The Lancet study, it was not done by The Lancet, which is a British medical journal. It was done by a group of Iraqi doctors and epidemiologists under the supervision of their counterparts at Johns Hopkins. And that number, I don't think it was 1 million. My memory was that it was about 600,000. Be that as it may, some of it was war deaths plus deaths attributable to the secondary effects of the war, disease, et cetera, et cetera. I can't tell you which is the correct number. But even if it's the lower number, George's wider point is well taken, which is to say, whether it's Vietnam or whether it's Iraq, in reminiscence of the war, we naturally focus on our war debt, and that's understandable, but there is another side of the story about what has happened. Now, let me just put this in context. It is not the case that American troops killed, whether the lower number is 111 to 122,000 or 600,000 civilians. This count involves insurgent killings, American killings, and in the case of the Iraq war count breakdown, 70% unaccounted for. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that a very significant proportion of urban Iraqis were killed. And when you have that going on, the secondary effects in terms of family, in terms of the prospects of the country's recovery, in terms of sheer trauma, PTSD, and all of this, if you think about this, it's a huge, huge social problem. And that is also being dealt with now. by the people of Iraq collectively.
Thank you so much, George, for your call. What is our presence in Iraq now, Rajan?
You know, I couldn't tell you offhand, Kathleen. I was sort of thinking about this actually on the subway right over here. I think it's very, very small. It's far smaller than, much, much smaller than what's present in Afghanistan. Maybe one of the callers who will call in could tell us. It is a negligible presence, and the burden of dealing with the security breakdown in Iraq is being dealt with first by the Iraqi army and police, then by private militias, and then in the north, the Kurds have their own forces called the Peshmerga, and they are protecting what I would say amounts to pretty much an independent state within a state in northern Iraq. That is the Kurdish regional government, or Kurdistan, as it's called.
Tom is next in Whitefish Bay. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. First, an aside, it's almost 44 years to the day that I was landing at Tanjung Air Force Base with a bunch of other guys heading out to our units to start our so-called service in Vietnam. So we talk about Iraq. There are a couple things. First, I want to recommend a book. It's called We Meant Well, and it's written by a former, or maybe current, I don't know, State Department employee about how we really botched any attempts to do nation building there. But in addition to that, I think that one of the things that we often forget is how these wars desensitize us as a society, and they make us think that somehow or other we're in charge of the world. We're the ones who have to make decisions for other people. It's almost a form of racism, it seems to me, to say that, well, the Iraqis can't decide what kind of government they need or want. We're the ones that have to decide. Secondly, one of the things we also forget, and following the election of the Pope, Pope Francis is now suffering from some questions being raised about his support for what was called the dirty war in Argentina. And somebody ought to begin thinking about how much this country supported that dictator and how many people were killed by that dictator. And yet we basically did nothing. Yet when it came to somebody like Saddam Hussein, he was probably just as bad. For some reason or other, we decided we needed to invade. Thirdly, one of the things that your guest mentioned, Kathleen, I'm sorry I've forgotten his name.
Rajan Manan.
Is the cost of these wars as they go on. Every month, you all send me a check for my disabilities. And next month, I get to go for a free checkup that's paid for by you all. And that will continue the rest of my life. I mean, there's thousands of other guys like me. And the continuing cost of these wars is something we forget. In addition to that, we also forget how it affected our deficit and the current argument about deficit spending. So I'll shut up now and let you get back.
Thank you.
I'm sorry it takes so long.
No, it was fine. Thank you for your contribution, Tom Rajan.
So, Tom, like your other guests, has made a lot of really good points. You have a pretty literate listening audience.
Yes, we do.
I have to say.
It's very
impressive. So on the point Tom made about us and our sense that we can deliver all things good to other societies, there's a long history in this country, starting from pretty much the Revolutionary War and the Declaration of Independence, that the United States is a special kind of nation. Now, for about 168 years of the country's history, roughly until about 1945, the notion was, well, that might be so, but except in the immediate neighborhood where there are significant security interests, it's best to sort of leave the rest of the world alone, do not trade with it or do not have diplomatic relations with it. But as you know, George Washington said in his famous farewell address, be careful of entanglements of various sorts. That changed after 1945 because of the Cold War. And I think after the Cold War came about this notion, the Soviet Union has collapsed, it's the end of history, liberalism as an idea has triumphed, it's a unipolar world, i.e. a world dominated by the United States. And some of the sort of optimism or hubris, whatever you want to call it, that Tom speaks of, took hold. And now those chickens have come home to roost because we've realized just really how complicated things are. Now, on his business, on his point about follow-on costs and the deficit and so on, here's the thing. I mean, if you project outward the costs of Iraq on a continuing basis, he's quite right, because veterans' bills and the upkeep of people who fought in the war will be needed. When you talk to war hawks about this, they're quick to remind you that, you know, we spend about 5-6% on defense, it's hardly a crippling burden, and all of that. But unfortunately, that's the wrong way to look at it. I'm not arguing that we ought not to have a proper military to defend the country and its interests. But if you look at the budget and look at discretionary funding, right, you take entitlements, all the third-rail things that cannot be touched off the table, defense spending accounts for a very, very large chunk of discretionary funding. And so in that way, it makes a difference. So there's a little bit of a numbers illusion here. Oh, we spent only 5%. The question to ask is, what proportion of the budget is it, and what proportion of discretional funding is it? And in that sense, you know, these campaigns, the total of these campaigns do add up. And I think the public, if the country's economy continues to be weak, and, you know, we're told that we're the first generation of Americans who will ask the question, will our kids have a better life than we do, if that turns out to be true, I hope it's not true, then these kinds of expenses will be much harder to justify. There's no question about that. And in that sense, Iraq and Afghanistan have had a legacy.
Thank you so much for your calls. We'll welcome more of them. Our phone number, as we talk about Iraq 10 years after the beginning of the Iraq War, 800-486-8655. You can always send emails. Our phones have been very busy this morning, and I don't want you to be frustrated. So send an email if you can at talk@wpr.org, or leave a message on our Facebook page where the conversation can be there and continue after the show. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Rajan Manan. He is professor of international relations in the Department of Political Science at the City College of New York. One of the things that we haven't talked much about is the reason we went into this war. And obviously, there was a lot of controversy about this, but there were no weapons of mass destruction. It was not a matter of national security as it was made out to be. I think, unless I'm missing somebody, the only person who has lamented his role in leading us to believe that there were WMDs is Colin Powell. Nobody else has said, you know, maybe we did the wrong thing here. There hasn't seemed to have been an examination of conscience.
True. You know, as a species, we humans are not noted for our introspection, let it be said. But it's probably much truer of political leaders. Your guests, your emailers and callers have made a number of criticisms of the war. And it is striking to me, as this is the anniversary, that when the principals involved in the war have been asked about all sorts of things, ranging from civil liberties to whether the war was worth it, to the cost of the war, would you have done it again, in very few cases, is there even a trace of second thought? This is actually very worrying, because it suggests that a good segment of smart people who had and may have in the future a say in the direction of the country haven't really learned anything at all and haven't had any occasion to reflect. I mean, Tony Blair's memoirs on this, I think, are kind of utterly self-serving in this respect. It's disappointment. None of the other memoirs are much different. Another question is this. Ron Susskind wrote a book called The 1% Solution, and he called it that because Mr. Cheney supposedly said, even if there was a 1% chance that all of the reasons that were given for Iraq were true, we had to go ahead and do it anyway. Well, nobody makes life calculations on that basis, right? We don't make big decisions if we think there's a 1% chance of the factual accuracy of things. But that was sort of the mindset. Now, I'm not defending what they did, but I was really struck by one of your guests said, George W. Bush came in as a person, so did Condi Rice, his Secretary of State eventually. We don't want to do nation building. Rice said, you know, American soldiers are not, ought not to be escorting kindergartners to school in other countries or what have you. 9/11, I think, had a catastrophic effect. I mean, I live in New York City. I remember that day. And this is a city that's not easily panicked. And it's the first time I've really seen genuine fear. And so in the context of that fear, I think the government was given a huge amount of leeway by the American public. After all, government officials can have a narrative. They're presumed to have more information. And so the linkage between 9/11 and Saddam and WMD, all of which now callers have said correctly, well, it's been shown to be untrue, there was a sort of credibility capital that the government had that it could draw on at the time that in retrospect may not be clear to us, but if we put ourselves back in that time, it might be a little clearer. Not to say that things were done correctly, but there was a context in which that war happened.
Yes, and does that explain, we have an interesting email from Stephen. After 19 Saudis and two Egyptians flew planes into the World Trade Center, how in the world did over one half of the American people come to believe that Iraq was responsible for 9/11? Is it because of what you just said, or is there more?
I think it's because partly of what I said. The Saudis sort of got a pass on this because they are not an American ally in the outright sense of the word, but they are a country with which we've done all manner of business for a very, very long time, their abominable human rights record notwithstanding. But I think that, I think what Stephen's point can be answered in this way. There was a genuine fear and panic because it was the first direct attack on the homeland in a very, very long time. Our defenses and security and our intelligence seemed utterly incapable. There was a worry about whether it would happen again. And within that context, people who wanted to wage the war. And by the way, there's another point to be made. There is a connection between the first Gulf War, that is the war that was waged to evict Saddam from Kuwait, which, by the way, President Bush Sr. waged with Security Council authorization, and a coalition that included a couple of Arab states, including Syria, it's interesting to note. There were people in the Bush senior administration who wanted Saddam gone then and never thought it was a good idea that we didn't march into Baghdad and overthrow Saddam. So when 9/11 happened, they had a chance to make that case again in a totally different context. That's important to note as well. In all of the histories of the war, and I've read a good many of them, this is a point that comes up over and over again, that there was a group that was determined on this occasion to make happen what they thought should have happened on the first occasion.
Let's go to Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I'm pro-ousting Saddam Hussein. I think that's a great thing we did because he was a very corrupt leader. But unfortunately, everything that we've been told that he did to his own people, you know, torture camps and, murdering families to get back at political dissidents, basically everything that he's done to his own people, we are currently doing to his people. I mean, currently we have torture camps built. We are actually even hauling people out of their own country, bringing them to an island, and torturing them. Basically, everything that he did to his own people, we are currently still doing to his people under the guise of freedom.
Are we doing that now, Rajan?
You mean torturing Iraqis?
Yes, are we taking people to these sites and torturing them for information?
Well, you know, I think the caller is talking about the rendition program.
Yes.
Which was a significant practice after the Iraq War. My own understanding is that under President Obama, not that everything has been perfect, you know, he didn't close Guantanamo Bay as he said he would, primarily because I think Congress would not have allowed it. But the rendition program and practices of torture like waterboarding have been significantly reined in. And one might argue that it's not enough, but I don't agree with the narrative that what Saddam did to his people, we're doing now to the Iraqi people. I think that's vastly overblown. That's a separate issue from the critic of the war. As for Saddam being a corrupt dictator and so on, well, yes, that's true. But, you know, as people have pointed out, this didn't seem to bother us in years past. And if you sort of made a rogues gallery of corrupt leaders and decided that you were going to go after them, I mean, we'd be pretty busy for many years.
Thanks, Mike, for the call. Dale in River Falls. Hi.
Hi. I have an interesting challenge for our guest, and that is to take this all down a notch. And he's talking to a group of 10-year-olds, so fifth graders, and what he's explaining to them is, here's what happened, and here's why we went into Iraq, and here's what was accomplished.
All right. Rajan?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
He wants you to address all of this as though you were speaking to 10-year-olds. Why did we go into Iraq and what did we accomplish? How would you tell this story to people in fifth grade?
Yeah, well, I've done it in the case of my own daughter, who was roughly that age at the time. And I would say something such as this. It's important, whatever you think of the war, to understand the context in which it happened. The context was 9/11. Without that, I cannot imagine that we would have gone into Iraq to overthrow a government and then to occupy the government for about a decade or so. That event, 9/11, I think created a sort of national security panic on the part of the leadership, which then trickled down into the body politic and society. In that context, and in the declared war on terror, almost presenting Al-Qaeda as the new Soviet Union, which was a big disservice, I think. There were many things that the government was allowed to do, especially because of its reassurance that based on hard evidence and hard calculations, it was clear that the following were true. WMD in Iraq, Saddam's connection with Al-Qaeda, perhaps Saddam's link with the 9/11 episode itself. And then there was the explanation that this could all be done very, very quickly. And there was, in a sense, if not a blank check, then a great deal of leeway given to the government by society. The interesting thing that young people need to take away from this, I think, is there's a paradox about America's role in the world, and it's connected with America's own internal practices. We are a country that's involved in just about every corner of the world, and we often believe that if we don't do something here or there, catastrophic consequences will follow and all of this. But generally speaking, your audience aside, because it's an exception, most Americans are not on a daily basis very interested in international politics, foreign cultures, foreign countries. And I say this as an educator, right? Mm-hmm. It's dismaying to me. So we can't have it both ways, it seems to me. Live in a democracy that should hold leaders accountable and have a robust public debate, and then suddenly get caught by surprise when things happened. And then we learn about all the history and details afterwards. So what I would tell the five-year-old is, maybe you're a little too young to start reading the New York Times or the NPR, but start looking at the world seriously, because as Leon Trotsky, the Russian leader, once said, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. Mm-hmm. You may not be interested in the world, but the world is interested in you.
Thank you, Dale, for the call. Elizabeth in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
I wanted to know if since the war there's been an increased rate of cancer or birth defects in Iraq, and has the depleted uranium affected our soldiers?
I'm sorry, I just cannot comment on that because I don't know.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for the call. Can you tell her a place where she can find out?
Yes, I think probably the Centers for Disease Control, websites that are really good on international affairs, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, I suspect. You know, she's welcome to find me on the web and email me, and I'll be happy to help her with more sources. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any.
Thank you, Rajan. That's a nice offer. We're reluctant to take any more phone calls because we don't have enough time. Thank you very much for being with us. It's striking to remember, I can't believe it was 10 years ago, all of the programs that we did on this so that we could understand and we could hear people's different points of view and how we forget about things once they're over. And there were so many things to learn from what happened, what we did, why we did it. We need to examine it, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. No question.
Thanks, Rajan.
Thank you. Dismal subject, but I've had an interesting time. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, we've had an interesting time as well. And thank goodness for the interest in our audience. Thank goodness for public radio. Sometimes you think that, don't you, that you can have these kinds of conversations and the phone lines are just completely filled. Rajan Manan, our guest this hour of the program, professor of international relations in the Department of Political Science at the City College of New York in New York City. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour. Thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Stay with us. Next hour, I'll talk to Wisconsin troubadour David Drake about folk music and how we can learn the history of Wisconsin through song. We should have a wonderful time. That's coming up. This is the Ideas Network.